I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When the U.S. president gives an address, he speaks to and represents hundreds of millions of people. The status of the office means that every word is felt and analyzed across the world. It's likely why many presidents include a speechwriter on their staff. Today, we'll talk to the man behind the pen of one American president. We'll learn the pressures of crafting a presidential speech that resonates with the common person and how the art of speechmaking has evolved over the years. Then, how far can a government extend its authority to keep its people safe without crossing an ethical line? I'll explore the ethics of quarantine and when it's okay for the people to revolt. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Craig Smith knows a thing or two about presidential speeches. One big thing to know, they can change history. They can also reverse the political standing of the person delivering it. Craig Smith worked on George H.W. Bush's Thousand Points of Life speech that he delivered at the 1988 Republican National Convention. It was a speech that kickstarted Bush's campaign against Michael Dukakis. Now, a conversation about the art of presidential speechmaking, the impact they can have, and why knowing a little bit about Aristotle might help. Dr. Craig Smith was a full-time speechwriter for President Gerald Ford. He also wrote speeches for Lee Iacocca and was a consulting writer to George H.W. Bush. He worked as a political consultant to CBS News, and he's the author of the book Confessions of a Presidential Speechwriter. He joins us today from Kansas Public Radio over in Lawrence. Craig, nice to have you. Good morning.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
You know, one thing that's always struck me, you know, about this speechwriting business is just how difficult a process this is. Was it difficult for you?
It wasn't as difficult as it is for others because I'd had so much practice on myself. I was a high school debater. I was a college debater. You get a sense of what valid evidence is and how to build an argument. And then I had studied the ancients, Aristotle on rhetoric, Cicero on oratory, Quintilian on the Institutes of Oratory, and you just put together a kind of checklist of the many different rhetorical strategies that you can use in speech writing. Then all you have to do, small step, is attune those to the persona of the client, and then the situation, and then the audience. So there are layers of complexity that go into it, and a lot of practice helps reform the process for you.
I'm wondering what Aristotle taught you about delivering a speech in great rhetoric.
Aristotle's book on rhetoric says that the most potent strategy for a speaker is building credibility. And he has several parts to the way you build credibility. One is your prior reputation. What decisions have you made in the past that should be lauded? Secondly is goodwill, and that means treating the audience as a friend, doing something for them without expecting something in return, which is very difficult for politicians to do. Then there's sagacity or wisdom, and that means you know what you're talking about. Speakers often stumble on that because they will misconstrue facts, and that undercuts their credibility. And finally, there's the notion of character, that you are a virtuous person. And then how do you demonstrate that? How does your speechwriter help you demonstrate that you're a person of character? And that's just credibility. You have appeals to emotion that you have to deal with. You have arguments you have to build with solid evidence. There's style and language. What level of language is the client comfortable with? When I went to work for President Ford, he said, I want to talk the language of the common man. Some of my speechwriters have been trying to make me into Woodrow Wilson. I'm not that eloquent. It doesn't come naturally to me. Please have me speak the language of the common man. And we did that for him. And I think it was very successful. We almost pulled that election off in 1976.
Yeah. How do you write for the common man? Again, that sounds like a fairly simple concept, but pulling it off is something altogether different.
Well, you know, Franklin Roosevelt actually did it. You don't use large words.
Right.
That's a mistake a lot of speechwriters make. But what you can do is take small words and make them rhythmic. You know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Those are all small words. Mm-hmm. That's the language of the common man. But the rhythm of it and the repetition of it makes it makes it memorable. And so using tropes and figures, oxymorons, antithesis, you know, we should never negotiate in fear, but we should never fear to negotiate, John Kennedy in his inaugural. Again, small words, but we remember them because of the antithesis and the rhythm and the repetition.
We're 3 minutes into this conversation, and I'm thinking to myself, you explained this very well, but it sounds still like really difficult work.
It is. I mean, it takes a lot of training and a lot of studying of persuasive strategies. I mean, beyond Aristotle, there are more contemporary writers like Kenneth Burke who talk about how a speaker can identify with an audience. You can identify with an audience in terms of substantial identification. So if I call the government a swamp, that makes it clearer to the audience. It brings it nearer to them, and it focuses an alienating picture on them. And then, of course, there's also consubstantial identification, which means that I identify with the audience personally. They become one with me in terms of our personalities. I was speaking at the Bob Dole Institute tonight, and Bob Dole is one of my favorite people. And in his acceptance speech in 1996, he described Kansas in the 1950s, and he said, "Let me be a bridge to that past." That was a way of identifying with people who had a nostalgia for the past. And Trump has used the same thing with Make America Great Again. If it were going to make America great again, it must have been great at some time in the past. And so he's identifying with his audience by going into a past. And that's a strategy that's proved fairly potent for him.
Craig, I would not have wanted to have been a speechwriter for one Bob Dole. That would have been a hard job. He wandered all over the place.
Yes. I never wrote a speech for Bob Dole.
I'm not sure anybody could.
It's difficult. And, there are some people that resist speechwriters. John Kasich, the former governor of Ohio, doesn't use speechwriters, never has, writes all his own stuff. And I think he's fairly effective at it.
How has the art of presidential speech making evolved over the years?
It's always been there. When George Washington was elected, he wanted an inaugural address, and he went to his secretary, and his secretary wrote him an inaugural address, and he threw it in the trash can. He thought it was terrible, and he sent a note down the road to his friend James Madison, and he said, "Can you write this for me?" And so Madison wrote Washington's first inaugural address. And then once he put his cabinet together, his favorite son, Alexander Hamilton, then began to write for George Washington and wrote his farewell address. And so the art of speechwriting goes back to the very founding of this country.
So when did presidents bring speechwriters onto their staffs?
Right at the beginning these days. It was fairly informal up until the Nixon administration, and Nixon did a great deal to advance the status of speechwriters. He let them put that label on the door. So it would say Patrick Buchanan, speechwriter, Ray Price, speechwriter. For all of the secrecy of the Nixon administration, speechwriting wasn't one of them. And so when I came into the Ford administration, we inherited the Nixon structure, which was five full-time speechwriters on a rotating basis, speech by speech. Under them were 10 researchers to make sure the speech was accurate and all the facts were accurate. Please take note, Trump people.
Yeah.
And then, we had direct access to the president. One of the evolutions that occurred after the Ford administration, in the Carter administration, was that the speechwriters did not have direct access to the president. And I think it hurt Carter. The speechwriter needs to go into the room with the president and talk about what the president wants, not what some advisor wants. And that was a mistake. And it's continued into other administrations where there's a distance from the speechwriters, and I think it's unfortunate.
How effective was Gerald Ford at telling you when you were in the Oval Office with him, Craig, exactly what he wanted?
He was very good at it. He was not as collaborative in the speechwriting process as George H.W. Bush was. When I worked in the campaign with George H.W. Bush, we would sit on the plane and mark up the speech together. He was my favorite client. President Ford and I became really good friends. I advised him about his kids and where they should go to college. And he would tell me what he wanted in a speech, but I didn't meet again with him until he delivered the speech. He didn't have much input input into the process if he liked the speech. If he didn't like it, then somebody else would have to, you know, repair it and write it anew. But that was fairly rare.
President George H.W. Bush, I think you have said, did not like to rehearse his speeches, which is right. Difficult for a speechwriter because after all that work, you want to see it delivered effectively. Why was he resistant to that idea?
For some reason, he thought it was, quote, unmanly, unquote. And I was able to convince him that having written for Lee Iacocca, and Iacocca rehearsed a lot in front of the mirror, in front of me, I was able to convince him that it was the key to mastering the pronunciation of the words. It was like a dress rehearsal. And then I had a very powerful ally in Barbara Bush. She was on my side all the time, and we became good friends, and she really insisted that he rehearse. And so when he did, he was very good. I mean, an example of that was the Wednesday night speech he gave at the 1980 convention, where he conceded that he had lost to Reagan and we now had to unite the party behind Reagan. Mm-hmm. And Reagan heard that speech, and that's what got Bush on the ticket. Reagan said, I want that guy on the ticket. And so, you know, he got on the ticket, he became vice president, went on to become president, and that one speech made the difference. And that's why speechwriters are so important.
Does it go without saying that rehearsal of a speech is essential?
Yes. Delivery is the sine qua non of a speech. You can write a gem of a speech for a client, and if they stumble through it and can't pronounce the words, it's ruined. And so that's why rehearsal is so important.
How did you get the job as a speechwriter for President Ford?
That's an only in America. I was teaching at the University of Virginia. I went down to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill to give a guest lecture. My lecture was at 10 in the morning. President Ford was coming to the campus to speak to the future homemakers of America at noon. And the faculty said, let's go over and hear the president. And so we went over and we listened to President Ford's speech, and it was pretty bad. It wasn't adjusted well to the audience. He kind of stumbled through it. I didn't see an organizational structure. I was just appalled. I went back to Charlottesville. I couldn't sleep. I wrote a 5-page single-spaced letter to the president, the White House, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And then I got to sleep and I didn't think anything more of it. And a week later, I was called. Somebody in the mailroom noticed my letter and put it together with the fact that a speechwriter in the White House had just been fired and sent the letter upstairs. And I got called by the Office of White House Personnel. I got called in for an interview. And by the end of the day, I met the president and was hired pending a security review. So only in America could that happen. It was just amazing.
That's just breathtaking to me, that just a cold letter by you because you were concerned about the quality of a speech the president gave resulted in how much time elapsed before you actually got the job?
The interview was a week after I sent the letter in. Jesus. And during that week, I understand, they called people who knew me that they knew and vetted me. And then I went up for the interview, and by the end of the day, they told me I had the job, and a week later, I started. I was put in a broom closet in the old executive office building and told to read all of the president's speeches and then to report back to the counselor for the president on my findings. And Bob Hartman said, what did you think? What kind of style does the president have? And I said, he doesn't have a style. It depends on who's writing the speech. There's nothing consistent here. Hmm. What we need to do is get a consistent style. And he said, well, we'll think about that. And then came the hazing. And that was my first speech that I was assigned. And it was for President Ford to deliver to the Southern Baptist Convention in Norfolk, Virginia. And of course, they were all pro-Carter people. And so this was a very difficult assignment. So there you had me, a Catholic, writing for yes. the president, an Episcopalian, yes. to give a speech to the Southern Baptist Convention.
I saw that.
and I consulted with Baptist ministers. I worked very hard on the speech. The president went down to Norfolk, and the speech went very well. The Washington Post praised it, said it was one of the best speeches the president had given. And so now I had my creds, and I could help reform the speechwriting operation in the White House.
So being flexible is one of the keys here. It's sort of like a talk show host. I may not know much about speechwriting, but it's the topic today, and I better figure it out pretty quickly, right?
Yes, you have to be adaptable. And that's one of the things that, you know, communication studies is good for, rhetorical studies is good for. They make a person think in many, many different ways. They make the person very adaptable. I mean, sometimes you want an inductive approach to a speech where you're going from examples to draw out a conclusion. In other cases, you want to be deductive, where you have a general rule that you want to put out there first and then prove it as you go through the speech. And just depends on the audience.
Craig Smith is my guest. We're talking about the art of speech making. He'll speak tonight at 7, speaking of speech making, as part of the 2020 Presidential Lecture Series at the Dole Institute of Politics in Lawrence. More information can be found at the Institute's website. That's doleinstitute.org. So did you have any idea what you were getting yourself into by becoming a speechwriter for a president of the United States?
No, and I was somewhat insecure because I hadn't written for anybody but myself, and to start at the top as a speechwriter, writing for the President of the United States was really daunting. But once he gave the speech in Norfolk, and then we went into the bicentennial speeches, and I was able to coordinate that whole project, and I put two speechwriters on each one of the 6 bicentennial speeches. You eventually got into a rhythm. And things went well. And then we came to Kansas City for the acceptance speech. Mm. And that was probably the best speech that Ford ever gave. And it got him back in the race.
How demanding a job is it then? Are you on deadline like you were once upon a time when you were at CBS News?
Yes, you're on deadline. You're on call. In those days, we had pagers. And for example, the Maya Ghez crisis happened. That is, the Cambodian government seized an American merchant ship, the Maya Ghez. And I remember I was away for the weekend, and I got a pager call, and they said, you get yourself into the White House as soon as you can. We need your help. And so you just drop everything and go into the White House, and you start writing and working with the policy people and the State Department, and everything comes together.
In a speech like that, you're pulling together strands from all sorts of different people, right? I mean,
yes.
you're merging a lot of different thoughts into one document.
Yes. And it's called staffing. Once you get a draft, the draft is put out to the relevant department. So if, for example, it was on agricultural policy or food bank policy or food stamps, it would have to be reviewed by somebody in the agriculture department. The problem is those staffers over in the agriculture department would suddenly think they were speechwriters. And they would, instead of advising on the policy, they would start changing the words of the speech around. And so we always had to guard against that. And luckily, Bob Hartman, our counselor to the president, always defended our drafts over any changes anybody wanted to make that were stylistic instead of substantive.
How big a staff did President Ford have on the speech-making side?
We had a counselor to the president, Bob Hartman, and under Bob, there were 5 full-time writers, and then we had an editor, Bob Orban, and then there was a layer of about 10 researchers under that, young people who were very bright, and we could leave things blank in the speech, and they would fill it in, like the inflation rate or the unemployment rate or any of the statistics we needed. We didn't have to worry about that. They'd be filled in.
You always hear throughout the years what a decent man Gerald Ford was. Tell us about him.
He was a wonderful man. The first time I met him at the end of that day of the interview, I was brought in and he was in the Oval Office puffing on a pipe. Mm-hmm. And Bob Hartman said, Mr. President, pending a security review, this is Craig Smith. He's a professor at the University of Virginia and he'll be your new speechwriter. And the president looked at me and he said, professors haven't done very well here. And I said, well, why is that? And he said, they don't meet their deadlines. They try to make me sound like somebody I'm not. I hope you won't do that. And I said, you know, Mr. President, I will do everything I can to make you comfortable with the speeches that I write for you. And after the Norfolk speech, he called me in one day and I said, what do you need today? I mean, where are we speaking? And he said, I want to talk to you about something else. He said, my son Steve isn't doing very well at the college that he's attending in mm-hmm. Utah, and he likes animal husbandry. And do you know anything about campuses that are good at that? And I said, well, Cal Poly San Luis Obispo is terrific at that. Why don't you transfer him over there? So it was that kind of personal rapport that I had with the president that was very rewarding. And he was just so honest and so decent and you know, so much the opposite of what had happened in Watergate. You know, he wanted to restore respect for the presidency. And I think we helped do that with the bicentennial speeches. We were lucky to have, you know, the celebration, the 200th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in 1976. And that really helped bounce us off the horror of Watergate.
If you have questions for Craig Smith on writing speeches for a president of the United States, 816-235-2888. Frank from Lawrence, you're on the air. Frank, good morning.
Thanks. Sir, writing speeches, can you give examples of when you wrote a speech for someone and they deviated and went off the topic that you wrote? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Frank.
Yeah, I can. And it was a funny instance. There was a speech I wrote for Gerald Ford, President Ford, to deliver in the East Room of the White House to the Pennsylvania delegation. As you recall, the nomination in 1976 wasn't determined
Yes.
until we went to the convention. And so he was giving this speech that I wrote, and then he decided to go off away from the script and tell a personal story. And then he went back to the script, and there was the personal story, and he went through it again. I'd already included it. So, yeah, you know, Bill Clinton was very good at going off script and doing a riff and then coming back to the script, although it drove his teleprompter people crazy. But, yeah, it does happen, and you have to tell your client, don't deviate from the script, please.
Hmm. Did you have teleprompters back in Gerald Ford's day?
Sometimes we did. It was a new thing, but we rehearsed him with them in Kansas City at the convention. The acceptance speech was rehearsed 5 times in front of live cameras to make sure, and up at the podium to make sure he was comfortable with the setting and with the speech.
What difference did that make?
I think it's really the teleprompters, if you know how to use them, are wonderful because you can appear to be having eye contact with the audience when you're actually reading a speech, and they can't see the speech from mm-hmm. their side of the teleprompters.
Yeah, they're amazing.
So you focus on the speaker.
What kinds of critiques would you give the president as he was rehearsing a speech? How frank could you be with him, Craig?
Well, I was always very gentle with my clients because you don't want to turn them off
and shatter their confidence, right?
Shatter their confidence, absolutely. And the spouses were very protective of their husbands. And I know from my conversations with Reagan speechwriters, Ken Kechigian, for example, that Nancy Reagan was very protective of her Ronnie. And Betty Ford was protective of Gerald Ford. And Barbara Bush was protected. Very protective of HW. And so you always wanted to have constructive criticism. I often would say to Barbara, you know, what do you think? I would issue a critique and then say, what do you think? And she would say, Craig, it's not important what I think. It's important what you think, much to her credit.
Well, she was the exception to the rule, it sounds like.
Yes, she was. Mm-hmm. And Rosalind Carter is another one. If you talk to some of Hertzberg and some of the other writers that worked for him, Rosalind Carter actually redrafted some things in some of the speeches, much to the dismay of the speechwriters.
So when you say the first ladies were sometimes protective of their husbands, meaning what? They couldn't stand a harsh criticism of their husband?
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, they're going to have to live with the guy up in the residence in the White House or on the campaign trail. And the conversation after the speechwriter leaves the room is going to continue in some cases. And so I think the spouses often didn't want a negative thing hanging over the speechwriting experience because they'd have to live with it.
You know, you've said that one key to writing a good speech is to understand, I guess, what a president is good at and what his comfort zone is. So compare George H.W. Bush to Bill Clinton to Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama, because you say that they were each good at something different.
Yeah, and they had different styles. Let me start in reverse. Barack Obama's style was what we call in the ancient world the periodic style. It's marked by marching paragraphs across the page. And so Lincoln had it, you know, of the people, by the people, for the people. It's very common in black pulpits, and that's the way Obama was comfortable speaking. It's kind of stentorian, but it worked for him. Bill Clinton, on the other hand, was very conversational. It was like he was talking to you in your living room. Mm-hmm. It wasn't periodic at all. It's called the loose and open style. Ronald Reagan had it the same way. What this plays into, I think, is what venue and what type of speaking works best for people. George H.W. Bush often did not want a text. He wanted to speak from notes. And his best venue, as far as I'm concerned, was press conferences. I mean, he was just terrific at press conferences. He had a mastery of the facts. He knew the name of every reporter in the room and had some nicknames for them. But he did not want to do his press conferences in the evening. And we, over and over again, we said, this is your venue. You're a star in these press conferences. You've got to do them in the evening like Reagan did, like John Kennedy did when they first went to the evening. And he wasn't comfortable with that. And by the time he said he was going to do it, the networks wouldn't go along because we were too far into the 92 campaign.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're writing a speech, Craig, do you know if that particular speech is destined for the history books? Are you aware that you might be making history with any speech that you write?
Well, there are certain speeches that get more attention than others, and you can get into the history books if you're lucky enough to be called on to write one of those. That would be an inaugural address, a State of the Union address, an acceptance speech. But every once in a while, you know, a tragedy will happen, and you'll be called on to write that. I think that one of the best speeches Barack Obama ever gave was after the Gabby Giffords tragedy, where people were killed. There was an attempted assassination of the congresswoman in Tucson, and he went down to the University of Arizona and gave a magnificent eulogy. I'm writing a book now about sacred oratory, and I'm including that speech as an example of a nonpartisan sacred speech that really rose to the occasion and should be remembered for a long time.
Well, all of this is just so interesting. That's Craig Smith, a one-time presidential speechwriter. Again, he speaks tonight at 7 as part of the 2020 Presidential Lecture Series over at the Dole Institute of Politics in Lawrence. More information about that, doleinstitute.org. Craig, thanks for taking some time. I really enjoyed that conversation. Such interesting stuff.
Thank you, Steve. It's been great being on your show.
After a short break, we'll come back and talk with our ethics professors about if America is on the brink of a revolution. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If there's one thing Valentine's Day is good for, it's chocolate. Tomorrow on the program, we'll find out what this holiday means for local chocolatiers, and we'll meet a guy who makes chocolate with a 3D printer. That's on the next Up to Date. Well, in the past few months, headlines have appeared in some publications asking a frightening question. Is America on the brink of revolution? It's true that revolutions aren't good for anybody in the short term, but at what point does the level of injustice reach a point where a revolution becomes the right thing to do? It's a big question. So is the question of when is it justifiable to impose a quarantine on a population, a move that can deprive large numbers of people of their personal liberties. The rise of the coronavirus, of course, is raising these concerns. When the questions get tough, we call in our ethics professors to kick them around and offer some guideposts. Our ethics professors today are Wayne Vaught. He's the provost at Utah Valley University and formerly the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at UMKC. Wayne, nice to have you on again.
Steve, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Adrian Switzer is also with us. He's an associate teaching professor in the Department of Philosophy at UMKC. Adrian, good morning to you.
Nice to be here.
Well, Adrian, let's start with staging a revolution here. Political scientists suggest that one criterion is the existence of tremendous economic inequality. Well, the U.S. can probably check that box. Is the table set, in your view, for a revolution?
This was certainly one of the justifications for the French Revolution, that the kind of average citizen in France leading up to the 1790 revolution felt that income inequality had become so outrageous that the aristocratic class was living an exorbitant life while they were barely getting by. And so there is a history of this. This is I mean, I think this is one way also to think about the American Revolution, that there was, you know, the taxation without representation, that it felt like the American colonists were being, you know, working, but not kind of seeing the benefits of their work. And a lot of that was going back to England. So this, there is a history of this, that, you know, if this income inequality or an unfair distribution of wealth starts occurring on a grand scale, that it's just, it's such a there's so much pressure on the working class. I mean, just because it's happened in the past doesn't necessarily mean that, like, it justifies a revolution. You know, if this was the prompt for the French Revolution and in some sense the American Revolution, but, you know, the kind of ethics of revolution might be something beyond that, you know, that might be one of the occasions for it. But, yeah.
You know, Wayne, I've been surprised we haven't seen more unrest as a result of this idea of income inequality in America that the stats say is so pervasive these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and it is hard to realize, you know, there's a book, What's the Matter with Kansas, that tried to address somewhat this issue several years ago in terms of why people continue to vote in their economic disinterest and in support of various other types of issues that they're concerned with. And I don't know if it just hasn't reached that tipping point. I think that we do see a lot of concerns, complaints. I think there still rests a lot of promise, a lot of belief that there are still these opportunities for the masses to move from one economic position to another economic position. And you see these very small samplings, you know, less than 1% of people who may be able to do such things. And so I think there's still hope out there in terms of a lot of people. But as that hope begins to diminish and as the economic realities begin to settle in, and especially if they continue to worsen, which seems to be the case, I think that you'll start to see much more unrest than there currently is. But I only suspect that there's still many people are comfortable enough or believe that there's still this possibility for economic mobility that still exists that is pacifying them at this time.
So, Adrian, maybe the big question here is there such a thing as an ethical revolution? Is there does a time ever come when turning to something like that becomes not only important to do, but the right thing to do?
It's a longstanding question in the history of social and political philosophy and just in the history of, you know, Western politics. A concern early on was that if we revolted against a standing government, we would call into question the very foundation for government. So a lot of early theorists said there could be no ethical grounds for revolting against an existing government, because laws would be called into question, you know, all the kind of forms of government would fall into disrepair. Someone like Edmund Burke wrote about this, about the French Revolution, that he thought that this was the worst thing to happen because they took an existing governmental system and just kind of threw it away. And he wondered, well, how do you begin again after you do away with all these structures that are in place? I mean, we in the United States, one of our founding philosophical texts, socially and politically, is Locke. You know, and Locke argues, and I think this speaks to Wayne's point too, Locke argues that kind of within reason of, are you able to live the life you want to live? Do you have the resources that are kind of sufficient for your understanding of kind of how to express yourself and develop yourself? And if so, then, you know, government can kind of come in and check areas of our life, as long as they don't trespass against that sense that, you know, I can kind of pursue my interests.
Reach my potential,
right? And he couches that in terms of property, which we could expand and think about in terms of economics. So again, I think this is kind of Wayne's point, is that a lot of us still believe that we have economic potential and we have, you know, some degree of possibility open to us. And as long as the government doesn't kind of get in the way of that, then, you know, he argues that, well, there's no really grounds for revolution when they start trespassing against that, when they start, you know, if the average citizen feels like what their potential is and what they want to do with their lives is really called into question or really undermined by the government, that might be a grounds for an ethical revolt.
I mean, the trick here, Wayne Vaught, is this idea that when you talk about revolution, you're probably talking about violence and mayhem and even death and injury on a massive scale. So doesn't that certainly up the requirements if you're talking about an ethical revolution?
It certainly seems that it would. And so now you might get into issues around just war theory, about justifications when taking another life is appropriate. The bar gets set particularly high. We've talked about Locke now, Hobbes, the concept of that if you were living in a situation which he refers to as this sort of the state of nature where life is incredibly difficult and harsh, and if one's living in a regime that would create a life and which is worse than, if not equal to, living in this state of nature, then it gives sort of a justification for one to revolt against that government. And again, I think that's kind of what the point that we're making here is that that's a pretty high standard. Now, you'll see revolutions, and many people from the United States have gone over to participate in revolutions in other countries where they're actively protesting against an oppressive regime, and arguably that their quality of life is so dismal that why wouldn't you want to overturn this government?
Yeah. You know, I think a lot of folks listening might be sort of even recoiling a little bit, Adrian, at the idea that we're talking about revolution. This is a concept that is largely foreign to Americans, even though we were born on the wings of a revolution. And I think, is it fair to say we've only had really one other massive revolution in our history, which, of course, was the Civil War?
I agree. I teach social and political philosophy, and you're right that, you know, the United States, among a few other countries, is really was founded in the cauldron of a bloody revolution. And yet I agree that ever since we've tended towards reformist politics, that a kind of gradualist change and working within the parameters of existing conditions is really the way that we tend to go. Years ago, I had the good fortune to live in Berlin, and there were kind of street protests weekly. You know, that I think that other cultures, especially in Western Europe, have a long tradition of, you know, not violent protests, but a pretty strong protest tradition. And we don't really see that as much here in the United States. I don't know exactly why that is. Maybe we, again, feel, as Wayne was saying, kind of, as long as I'm living my life in accordance with kind of how I see it, and as long as no one's really kind of getting in the way of that, I don't feel like the pressures are strong enough to kind of get me out into the street. Maybe it would take a much larger kind of economic collapse, like we saw close to in 2008, where kind of the scale of economic trouble kind of came home to us.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's true that I agree that we don't really have a rhetoric around really revolutionary discourse, you know, in America. Even, you know, Bernie Sanders will sometimes use language of revolution. And I think some people recoil at that, even though he's not talking about, you know, a bloody revolution. He's talking about transforming kind of economic situations. But I think he runs certain risk for that.
Well, Wayne, it sounds like you and Adrian are in agreement here that we haven't reached the tipping point here yet.
I think so. I mean, Adrian's point about violent protests, I think, is generally right, though. I think we have seen some of that in the United States, particularly around racial issues, the Black Lives Matter, the issues in St. Louis and the like, where you do have these radical protests in response to very, very real injustices. And so it seems that there's certainly a potential. Whether or not I get, you know, that's the point is, in what sense are these demonstrations, and if we go back to the 60s, the same type of violent demonstrations versus more peaceful protests, how do you defend one versus the other in terms of its ethical justification? And again, the need for sometimes even the appropriateness of violence can come into play when there's no other way of achieving the justice that really has to occur.
Adrian?
Yeah. So I think this is a good distinction to make, is that our assumption is revolution is something that occurs on a mass scale and, you know, transforms from one governmental system into another.
Right.
There is, Black Lives Matter, certainly the civil rights movement throughout the 60s are, you know, indications of a protest history in our culture. But if we are talking about revolution, and there's some reason to not you just use revolution in that sense, that we go from one governmental system to another. But it's that, like, I think that's the thing that we don't have a lot of talk around.
Right.
There's room for protests, but revolution is just on a whole other scale.
Absolutely. Well,
in reading about this, there seems to be this other truism out there that suggests that political scientists say that it's rare that they've been able to forecast a revolution, to see one coming before it arrives. For example, hardly anybody saw the Arab Spring coming. Few predicted the end of the Cold War. So maybe we won't even know if there's one in the offing here, Wayne.
it's quite possible that you just don't know what will be the catalyst for something like that to occur. But you can point to some of the, and we've already pointed to the economic oppression as one of the areas. And so when you're starting to see on a meter that there is growing disparity and growing economic disparity, it should put on our radar that really something should be done to address that, or you're adding to the potential fuel that could cause that in the future.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking today with our ethics professors about a series of issues. Wayne Vaught joins us. He's the provost at Utah Valley University. Adrian Switzer is a philosopher at UMKC. Let's turn to a different topic. The number of people infected and killed by the novel coronavirus continues to climb worldwide, with the death toll now topping 1,000. Strict quarantine measures are said to be helping to contain the disease, but the fear continues. For our ethics professors, Wayne, is there any doubt that quarantine is justified in a situation like this one?
Quarantine becomes a critical component. It again goes back to this issue of individual freedoms and the rights and responsibilities that individuals have versus the government's need to protect the populace as a whole. And so quarantine comes in as a way of balancing that, the greatest good for the greatest number, and subjecting individuals to a restriction on their rights and their liberties in order to protect the whole. I think the issue isn't about whether quarantine is ever ethically justifiable. It's the means and mechanisms by which that gets employed. Mm. And so if you still have to, I think, use the least restrictive measure of limiting and restricting access and limiting exposures, but that wouldn't mean, and you're starting to see, and I think potential racial discriminations and things that can come into play where, okay, now we're just going to target anyone because they're Chinese, for example, or something like that, or not providing adequate support and resources for the people who've ultimately been quarantined, and just kind of treat them as if so you can treat them anyway. So I think that there are ethical issues that surround the use of quarantine, though quarantine itself can become a essential tool for trying to contain the spread of this disease.
Well, Adrian, what Wayne is describing is a fairly fine balance here between personal liberties and restricting a population at a very tenuous time. That strikes me as it's a hard balance to strike.
Yeah, some of the news that we've been reading from China is a kind of lack of transparency as to how this circumstance and how the situation has been handled, that, you know, the early information about the virus wasn't really disseminated, that one of the doctors, I think, who was initially involved in diagnosing was, kind of sidelined. And so I think that's one way that this issue, or this tension between individual liberty and, you know, for the good of the overall population, can be navigated, is just in terms of, you know, the government being forthright or forthcoming about how situations are being handled and the circumstances, even the number of people who are infected. I feel like this news is just kind of keeps trickling out, and I for the average citizen, that kind of lack of transparency about how the government is interacting with the population, that's just going to aggravate certain, you know, worries about trespasses against individual freedom.
So transparency, in your view, is one ingredient that has to be in place.
I think it's an important part. I mean, I know the other side of that is, and you know, I haven't read this in particular, with the coronavirus, is just kind of fanning the flames of fear. Mm-hmm. You know, that if we are too out front of this and talk too much about it, then people who aren't infected will, you know, maybe self-diagnose and think they are, or they'll, you know. And so a government does have that consideration as well, that they don't want to kind of cause a mass hysteria over something that, you know, is reasonably in check or not reasonably in check. So there too, there's this kind of, you know, how much information should be disseminated, how is it rightly disseminated?
Right.
I think this raises kind of another layer of it.
Wayne Vaught, what else should be in place before a government can do, you know, something as drastic as imposing quarantine here?
Well, I think you know, Adrian's pointed out to some of the things is getting out ahead of, recognizing, not trying to keep things secretive, which appears to be at least the media's reporting that might have been some of the issues that are at play. I think making sure that people are aware of how they can protect themselves. So mm-hmm. this gets into
right.
Media campaigns about effective, just things that people can do on a daily basis, just to prevent access to potential exposures. You know, governments need to have in place, and I think that it's been a conversation that always goes on, and then it kind of goes into, it wanes a bit, and people don't really focus on it. But you know, what are we doing when there might be an outbreak and resources become limited? How are we communicating to people where they can go, where they shouldn't go to get treatment,
right.
So that we're not exposing others? But there's just a lot of information, a lot of strategies that can be put into place that can help contain the rate of exposure, and those things need to be implemented. Again, I think what you always want to do is use the least restrictive measure
right.
necessary to prevent the spread and exposure, and then you eventually get down to having someone under house arrest, as it were, or whatever, in their homes, who might have come into the country after exposure while they're in that incubation period, so you can be sure that they're not carrying the virus.
You know, Adrian, counterintuitively, there's some question out there among medical experts about how effective quarantine is to begin with. And if it's not that effective, does that begin to undermine any justification for quarantine? Although the numbers we're seeing in China would suggest that the quarantine appears to be having some effect in terms of lowering numbers in some of those provinces. Mm-hmm. But what about that part of it?
Yeah, Wayne is really the person to speak to this as the bioethicist and the person really well trained in this area. But I think this speaks to a disconnect between the sciences generally, but we'll just talk about the medical sciences and kind of the general understanding of them. I mean, medical scientists, and Wayne, please cut in and correct me if I'm wrong here. I mean,
Absolutely.
Medical scientists, you know, work within, you know, research methodologies where there are degrees of uncertainty, and, you know, they run hypotheses and they have test cases and these kind of things. And so the sciences are not exact.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most scientists would accept that as just part of their, like, that's what they do. You know, that's why they run repeatable experiments. That's why they're open to kind of revision of things. But I think what happens is that gets translated sometimes into popular kind of wisdom as, well, it's just a possibility. You know, maybe mm-hmm. this disease isn't as bad as people are making it out to be. Or, you know, maybe we see this a little bit with the vaccine and anti-vaccine movement that, well, you know, vaccines are, there's a degree of uncertainty. And that, again, I think that in this kind of telephone game, kind of metaphor gets disseminated in a way that, as if the scientists don't know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So if there was just a way in which the this speaks to kind of philosophers or academics involved with the kind of field of science, is, you know, conveying information in a way that says, yes, we're not talking about 100% certainty here,
mm-hmm.
but within the realm of, you know, the practice of our science, we know what's good for the, you know, like, it's better for you not to be exposed to this kind of virus.
Right.
You know? So
right.
I don't know that kind of answers your question a little bit diagonally, but
yeah. Well, what do we know about the effectiveness of quarantine, Wayne? And does that undermine all this?
I wouldn't even give statistics on that. I think that there are concerns and have been about how effective it can be, especially when you have something like a widespread pandemic, which appears to be, on the verge here with the coronavirus, because the spread becomes so widespread. It goes through airports. You have this worldwide exposure, the question becomes, is that even an effective tool
right.
At all, versus when you have these isolated cases? So I would have to defer to experts on this, but I think what is critical from an ethical issue is that those in positions of power and governmental authority positions who are unable to implement, whether it be quarantine or whatever else, really have to rely on the medical experts, as I think Adrian has pointed out.
Yeah.
Because what is unethical is to implement, again, a restrictive practice on someone, and especially if there is no legitimate and defensible argument to say that this is going to be effective, now you're restricting someone's rights. You have no ethical justification for doing so, and you're causing an ethical harm.
We're going to have to wrap
up. That's the ethics of that.
Okay, that's the voice of Wayne Vaught, provost at Utah Valley University, formerly of UMKC, Adrian Switzer with the philosophy department at UMKC. Gentlemen, thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, a 2020 forecast from the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. Esther George talks about four indicators she's keeping her eyes on. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Angstrom. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.